the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm one of your other co-hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
I'm the last co-host, Michael Scavarla at Penn State.
And we are joined by a very special guest here today. Very special guest, please introduce yourself to the Arthropod crowd.
Hi, I'm Tierney Brocious, and I'm at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois.
Rock Island, Illinois. I don't know any special facts about Rock Island, Illinois. I think I've driven through it.
We're one of the quad cities, so we're here with Davenport, Moline, Bettendorf, so kind of right on the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
What is Augustana College known for, or what can you tell us about your college?
Well, I know that a lot of people confuse it with Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We're the original Augustana College, from what I understand. But we're a small liberal arts college, you know, only about 2,400 students.
What's your mascot?
We are the Vikings. Nice. So kind of that Scandinavian heritage background.
I identify with that. Well, very cool. Thank you for joining us today. We're excited to chat with you. Jody's lined up a pretty cool outline for us to go through here today. And I guess first off, we should say that she and I have met you before. I think we met in Wisconsin, right? Yeah, that was cool. And we were introduced by Doug Golick to you. And I think it's because you went to Nebraska, correct?
Yeah, I did both my master's degree and my PhD at the University of Nebraska in entomology.
And who were you working with while you were there?
I was working with Leon Higley and Tom Hunt. People over in the applied ecology building.
So what kind of brought you to UNL when you and to study entomology? Like, what's the story on how you ended up doing that?
Well, I grew up as just one of those 4-H kids in Nebraska, and I was always drawn to insects, and I did the 4-H collections all the way through. And extension educators were always a really important part of that. Keith Jarvie, who was located in Northeast Nebraska, actually gave me the opportunity to keep a light trap in my backyard one summer. And I kind of would go out and collect and count the number of ag pests, looking for European corn borer, cutworm, identify that stuff, you know, which is the dream of every high school kid, I'm sure. but it was a paying gig and it was great. You know, then I went to Wayne State College in Nebraska and worked with Tom Hunt up at the extension station up there, working in the field. And then when I was finishing my biology degree and I was interested in entomology, Tom Hunt happened to have an opportunity to work with soybean aphid with Leon Higley. So kind of walked into my master's degree that way, looking at applied ecology, natural enemies, that sort of thing. And then when my PhD came around, I was really interested in conservation. So when the opportunity to work with Salt Creek tiger beetle came up, that's where I focused my PhD.
So tell the listeners a little bit about Salt Creek tiger beetle, because as somebody that used to live in Nebraska, I've heard about this bug and I know why it's important. But I'm guessing that for a lot of people listening, it's not necessarily on their radar. So why was this something that you needed to study?
So the Salt Creek tiger beetle is endemic to essentially just the salt flats there in right around Lincoln, Nebraska. And my understanding with the history of Lincoln as part of the reason that community was established was the kind of thought that there was an opportunity to mine salt there because of what they were kind of seeing with those salt flats. It turned out later that it wasn't a mineable source of salt because of the way it was kind of laid down. But that kind of created this interesting ecosystem. And the Salt Creek tiger beetle has kind of become, I think, an umbrella species that by preserving the tiger beetle, it preserves the rest of that sort of unique habitat. So lots of different, you know, plants and other insects. And then it's a great stopover location for waterfowl as they move through the area. So it's a pretty special place that I don't think a lot of people see is that, and really you drive right by it as you're going on the interstate through Nebraska.
I think people drive by most things in Nebraska is kind of the joke.
That's true. People are always like, oh, Nebraska. I'm like, no, you've only been on I-80. You don't understand. Absolutely beautiful state. You have to get off the interstate.
So you grew up in Nebraska?
Mm-hmm. Both myself and my spouse, we both grew up in Nebraska. So we're very fond when we get back quite often.
That's good. I'm a transplant and I was working in Lincoln for quite some time. I do hear a lot about the Salt Creek tiger beetle. Dave Spomer just did a seminar in the department a couple weeks ago about it. It was packed. So people are very interested in it. I mean, people love tiger beetles. When we think of a tiger beetle, I always think of the six-spotted, right?
Yeah, because they're absolutely beautiful. Yeah, that metallic
green. Fast.
Yeah, I think that they're, you know, among the most charismatic insects because they often do come in these really vivid colors. And then they have some really fun behaviors where they kind of fly off just a few feet ahead of you. They'll actually kind of sometimes turn around and kind of look to see where you're at. They're kind of active predators. And I think for entomologists, there's definitely a challenge in collecting them since they're such visual predators. They're really tricky to catch. And I think that there is kind of a sporting challenge when it comes to them. I was out actually collecting some tiger beetles. We were working on a research project at Augustana, and I was out with a colleague, and, you know, I had caught like, you know, 15 to his like 2. And I'll admit, I had a little bit of pride, like, yes, I am an entomologist. I've been training for this for years. You know, I was able to show up my colleague, and he'd actually brought his sons along. So it was kind of fun to show him up in front of his kids.
Is your hair kind of modeled after the tiger beetle color?
You know what? Yeah, I think I've always really liked that metallic green sheen that bugs have. And after I got tenure a couple of years ago, it was my celebratory, like, I don't have to comply. But if this is like my one rebellion in my entire life, so you can tell that not too rebellious now.
Very Midwestern of you.
Yeah, pretty much.
What is the trick to catching them?
So the one thing I've found is you have to kind of, you know, you sneak up on them, and instead of like flopping the net down on top of them, you kind of have to get, you know, almost a rhythm down, and you sweep over the top of them. So catch them as they're going straight up, and then you get them in your net that way. But the tricky thing is a lot of them, if you're out there on like those windy sand hills, they'll use the wind to their advantage and actually kind of get caught up in a wind gust as it goes by. And every species has slightly different timing, so how quickly you need to swing. So you get into a rhythm when you're catching them, I'd say.
If I'm not collecting and I'm just out walking, they're following me. You know, like, and I'm like, I just saw it. And then I'm moving, and then it keeps coming to where
I
am.
Yeah. Well, I think that as you're walking, they kind of move out of your way. And then as soon as you walk past, they just come on back. You know, they're not bothered by us. You know, they're just like, oh, get out of this person's way and come back and hunt for other animals to eat.
They are so cool. And the question I get a lot is, how can we make the Salt Creek tiger beetle our state insect?
That'd be awesome. What is the state insect of Nebraska currently?
Honeybee?
It is the honeybee.
Yeah, that's a horrible, not to throw shade on the honeybee, but it's not even native.
Throw all the shade you want.
There are a lot of states that have the honeybee as their state insect.
Yeah, no, that's troubling. Yeah.
So you've worked a lot with the adults. Have you done anything with the larvae, like gotten a piece of grass to fish them out of their little holes?
I have gotten to do that before. That's actually pretty fun. It took me a long time to finally figure it out. My favorite thing now is if you find the little burrows, just to kind of throw like a couple little pieces of sand in there, and they'll kind of like, all of a sudden you wait a few seconds and they'll pop them back out. Like they kind of like get irritated when you like throw stuff into their burrows. So they're feisty. And I've reared some in the lab, you know, they're kind of fun lab pets to have. I'd like to continue working with them. I've been doing a little bit with Bob Peterson and Leon up at Yellowstone National Park, working with a species that lives along the thermal pools up there. So it's Cicindela hemorrhagica.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat to run around thermal features and work with tiger beetles. But we're not running on thermal features, let me clarify. We're being very careful.
Yes. All in.
What were the changes between, I guess, being a student and then now being a professor?
Well, I mean, they're different. And I was kind of explaining this to a faculty member the other day. It's interesting now that I look back on, like right now I'm learning about photosynthesis because we switched up our intro bio section. And before I hadn't been covering that content. So it's the first time I've covered photosynthesis since I was a student. And I think as a student, we're so worried about all the little details that we have a hard time stepping back and understanding like the big picture. And it's really hard to get students to understand that, because we are kind of cramming them with all of this new jargon and all of this new terminology that they've never heard of before. And I think that there's a sense of panic in their minds, right? So they're just spending all this time memorizing. And I was guilty of that too, because now when I'm learning about photosynthesis, I'm seeing all these bigger connections. And that's because, you know, I've been trained as a scientist, and I wish I could get, that's the big thing. Like now it's like, how do I get them to relax a little bit and take a step back and then understand how this fits into kind of a larger picture of what biology is and how it functions. So yeah, as an instructor, that's kind of where I'm sitting now. It's like, how do I get them to, you know, to love this because of how it all works.
I think that's an interesting thing to point out, and it kind of reminds me of some of the other stuff that it sounds like you've worked in terms of connecting with people, trying to teach them about science, and it sounds like in a lot of ways you've tried to use emotion a little bit to try and help get people to connect with the material that you're bringing to them. In terms of things like the Salt Creek tiger beetle and even your work now, what is it about emotion that you try to do? Like, how do you try to connect with them in that spectrum?
While I was working on the Salt Creek tiger beetle, I had this kind of fun side project that my advisor, Leon Higley, it was great to have him because he was really supportive at understanding that something like the Salt Creek tiger beetle or any conservation action at all, without that sort of sense of the community support or people understanding its importance, any conservation action is going to be a real struggle. So my interest is there's a lot of ways to connect with people emotionally, but I've always been interested in visual art. I'm kind of a scientific illustrator on the side. So,
kind of. Oh my gosh, you're a huge deal. We'll talk about that.
Well, some of the people I hang out with, I'm certainly just still in the dabbling stage. I know some pretty amazing scientific illustrators. But yeah, so I've done scientific illustration. And as part of my dissertation, I actually helped curate art exhibits that surround, you know, all the artists contributed pieces that were either about the beetle or about that ecosystem. And it was really interesting just to kind of see people connect with that landscape, you know, within an art exhibit.
When you talk about connecting with them through art, art is a very ancient thing, of course, and it has a lot of power. But how do you merge insects and art together? What is it about? How did you do that with the Salt Creek tiger beetle even? Because I know that when I talk to people in Nebraska about that insect, you would get some shrugs, right? Like you'd get some people to be like, it's a tiny beetle. Who cares? I want to build a new development over there. So what is it that you do with the art? I know that scientific illustration is about showing people the anatomy, but is that going to convince them to love the bug? Or what did this exhibit look like, I guess, is maybe the shorter version of my question.
Well, the thing that I always tell people when I kind of talk about scientific illustration is really it's about communication. And so some scientific illustration might be real technical about the anatomy, but some scientific illustration will connect more into that emotional connection or kind of showing the importance of something visually. And I think that by bringing that tiger beetle up to something that is not just a little bug or something that's really small that you can't really see the details of, I think that once it's in your face and kind of larger than life, that people tend to connect a bit more. And the one thing we tried to do with that exhibit is not only have like these beautiful pieces of art, but we actually had curated insect collections. So, and actually showing some of the diversity of the insects that came from there. It's not just about the beetle. And I think that trying to make people understand that it's not just about the beetle. The beetle is actually providing a framework that, hey, we're starting with this beetle, but realize there's this whole ecosystem behind it.
When you say larger than life, that makes me really want like a tiger beetle arch over I-80 outside of Lincoln. I think that'd be
amazing. Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I think we should definitely link the article that was in American Entomologist about it. I love the picture of the beetle with that giant, the big frame, the gold frame that's around it.
Yeah, that art piece was, I think it was like 6-7 foot long by like 5 foot tall. That was a big piece.
Oh, wow. That is much bigger than I had assumed based on the article.
Yeah. So Jessa Hubig-Reitinger, she had that project that kind of fit for a long time that they were actually going around and displaying kind of these large images. And that's what she specialized on, was doing giant paintings of it. And she really had this thing that she noticed that people responded to her artwork much differently when we could actually see insects kind of at our scale. So I think a lot of times, you know, I'll talk to my students a lot about how, you know, we're kind of these giants of the earth walking around and we miss so much of the really interesting detail that's out there. I think even E.O. Wilson will talk about, you know, how most of the processes that are going on in the world are actually happening at a much smaller scale. And I think that smaller scale, I've really been getting interested into like slime molds lately. You go and you flip over a log and you see all the slime mold and the fungus. And I mean, it's truly beautiful when you look at all the different, shapes and textures and colors and diversity. And I think that's maybe part of it too, is that there's just, something gorgeous about the sheer diversity that you see at that scale that we don't see on a larger scale. So
can't see the forest for the trees.
Exactly.
I'd like to go back to talk about you being this amazing scientific illustrator instead of just, a little bit of dabbling, but you were part of the cicada for the Advocate Entomology logo. I didn't know that was you.
Oh yeah, that was me.
And how does that feel to see? Because when you go to these meetings, it's everywhere all the time, and
that
all
was pretty cool.
I thought that was one of the better logos we've had, at least since I've been part of ESA for the last 10 or 12 years. Like it was really creative and just really well done.
Well, I was part of a whole team of people. Bob Peterson had contacted me, and, we threw a lot of different ideas out there about, what that logo should look like. And we definitely wanted it to, I think the idea was, is if actual entomologist was involved in the drawing of it, it'd be a bit more of an accurate representation, rather than a lot of times you'll see more of a cartoonish, characterization of an insect. And I think most entomologists actually prefer a more scientifically accurate rendered image. Because in the past, I've heard people kind of grumbling whenever it's something that doesn't even look like the insect that it's supposed to be representing. So it was a fun project to work with.
Scientists not appreciating art, huh?
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to another artist, Jessie Smith. She's the one that's responsible for making those really cool belt buckles that people have, like the tiger beetle head. Yeah, and she was saying that with some of the jewelry pieces she does, that if her market audience is, kind of a group of entomologists, she can only push the artistic interpretation so far before the entomologists are like, nope. That's wrong. That's inaccurate. So she has to keep things pretty, pretty accurate to make this crowd happy anyway.
I have one slide in my intro entomology for master gardeners. And I talk about, like the wasps and the bees and then the flies. And sometimes it doesn't matter in certain audiences. And I said, but when you're getting a tattoo and you're looking for a bee, I said, look at all these tattoos. Like, these are actually all flies. Like, for me, that would matter. They were like, oh. And so now they all look for things and they bring it to me and they're like, is this really a fly? And I was like, yeah.
I have a cousin who has a tattoo of a dragonfly, and it's definitely more likely that it looks more like an owl fly to me because it has really long antennae. I'm like, oh, that's not even the same order. Like,
that's not what that is.
How did you get your start in art? I'm just kind of curious. I know Jody and Mike have both taken insect illustrating classes. Mike took it with Arwin Provancha, right?
Yeah.
The only course that I did at UNL, I did it last year. I did it with Lana.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah. It was hard. It was way hard. That's likely why I'm just so in such awe of the enormous amount of time it takes. I'm so glad I did a bed bug because she said, do something that you don't mind seeing like pretty much every day forever. Mm-hmm. I felt like, and I'm glad that I did that because I use it in all my presentations and I use it in a lot of my slides. And so my one drawing I use a lot. So
that's awesome. Yeah. And actually I took scientific illustration with Lana too. And that was a great class. But before that, I was always drawing as a kid. And I think that was kind of my way to engage with nature. So if I wasn't catching bugs and making my collection, I was out, drawing nature. And I have like all my old sketchbooks kind of filled with drawings of plants and things like that. Yeah. And I've always tried to keep up with having a sketchbook. I'm not as good about it as I should be. I wish I was a little bit better. But I think that, I took art classes all the way through high school and then, actually almost have an art minor from college. But I think there was always kind of that, what should I choose, art or science? And I think the final logic was I can do art as a hobby, but science is a bit harder to do as, just hobbyist scientist, doesn't really exist. And also, I'm not quite a first generation, college, graduate, but kind of close to that kind of coming from a, you know, middle income family, you know, getting degrees in art sounds a bit scary to parents often because like, well, what are you going to grow up to do? But, you know, when I was in graduate school for like my ninth year, my mom was probably also starting to get a little bit nervous about what are you going to do? Where's this all going? But yeah, so I think it was a combination of, you know, I've always loved it. And it was kind of nice that later on in my career, when I took, you know, Lana's class, I was like, wait, there's this thing, scientific illustration that includes both. And I was, you know, absolutely tickled. So, and I've tried to keep that up. And really, I've been more and more using it as a teaching tool, because I think that students have a really hard time when you say, hey, observe this or look at this. Our students, I think their observational skills are lacking, because, and I don't know if it's access to technology, immediate reward for looking up a YouTube video to look at something really quickly, but just their ability to sit still and quiet and really look at some sort of organism in front of them and make observations on that is really hard for them. And so I found that drawing, given a certain framework with it, is a really great way to get them to slow down and make those really fine observations. And I mean, I think when Jody took this class, you know, that I think anybody can draw. I think the idea that it's a skill that you're either born with or not is not true. I think that as just like anybody who can play a piano, given enough lessons, and you can play a tune that anybody's going to recognize. I may never be, you know, a Beethoven or have a natural gift for piano, but I can learn how to play it. And I think that drawing can be approached in the same way, that if you're given the tools, anybody can draw. You may never be a, you know, a gifted artist, but you can certainly draw well enough to publish, you know, your drawings in some of your scientific, you know, journal publications, and those sorts of things. So a lot of my students come at it kind of fearful, like, I can't draw, you know, don't make me draw. And then they're like, oh, okay, I see what you're saying here.
That sounds like a very nice and open, opening environment, in your classroom.
I try to, I'd say that I think my students would say that it's a pretty welcoming environment in my classrooms.
Sounds nice. I like the tune that you're singing there, I think.
And just to go with that a little bit, I think especially with scientific illustration, if you're not a quote-unquote artist, it gives you, like you mentioned, a framework to, this is the thing you're drawing. Having taken a scientific illustration class, I can do scientific illustrations. I draw everything for my own publications. But when I try to do, like, my wife's an oil painter. When I try to do other kinds of art, I find it really difficult because it's too open and there's not enough restrictions on, like, here's what you're doing. Stay within this framework that's established.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think most scientists like to have framework, right? We tend to be individuals who like to take precise measurements and know exactly. But at the same time, I think that jump, once you have those skills, to going to doing something a bit more creative outside of that framework, you may find that that's enjoyable, you know, as you kind of move on. I mean, I really love watercolor. I really love the, you know, expressiveness and kind of the, I don't know, the messiness of it, but I'm horrible at it. Like, let's be clear about that. But I aspire to do it because I like that there is less framework with it, but I find it really difficult because, and then of course these more precise drawings are right up my alley. I can handle that.
What do you work in? Like, what are your favorite media? And
for the most recent thing and project I worked with, I worked with Michael Samways. Originally I was going to illustrate the whole book, but then, you know, graduating with my PhD, having two kids, trying to get tenure. I did four chapters of the textbook. It's a really highly illustrated textbook on insect conservation. I really highly recommend the textbook. I just got a hold of it and it's wonderful. But for those drawings, I use something called Scratchboard. And I really like that because it's forgiving. You can put down ink. And then the nice thing about it is you can scratch it right off if you screw up. And I do. And there's some sort of quality to it, too. I don't know how to describe it. It gives it kind of a bold line. I don't know how to describe the texture that it gives you, but I really like the look of it. It's kind of a graphically bold style that I really appreciate, especially when most of these drawings, I would start quite large and then get shrunk down. So you didn't want to put a lot of fine detail because that would get lost as it got modified to go into a textbook.
You did the cover for that one, right?
Yeah.
That is the coolest.
Yeah, that was a really fun. Yeah, it's an Atlas beetle holding the world with an Atlas moth on top of it.
Oh, that is really cool.
It's hard to perhaps convey over an audio medium what we're talking about here.
I think you are super talented in both arts and science. So how do you maintain that high level in both for your art? Because that's not just hobby, right? You are doing this still as job, right?
Well, I mean, I would say that I wouldn't call myself high level in all of those areas. I mean, I think the number one thing that I prioritize just because of the nature of my job is the quality of my teaching. Because I'm 100% teaching. Like, technically, the research that I do is purely because I love it. And I also think it does make me a better teacher, right? And it gives my students an opportunity to do hands-on research. We go very slow where I'm at because there are no grad students, which is kind of nice for me because I still go out in the field. I'm still out there tromping through the dirt, you know, in the mud, which I think sometimes a lot of PIs at large institutions, they don't get to go out in the field as much. But at the same time, my students aren't as skilled as a graduate student, for example. So very slow there, but at the same time, it's really helping these students inform their decisions when they move to the next level. Is this something they love? Is this something that they would maybe not prefer to do for a living? And really, I think both of those decisions are perfect outcomes for the type of opportunity that I provide for the students. But it's really fun now because when I go to these ESA meetings, I look around and I've got, you know, three or four students that are currently there in graduate school. And it's really exciting to see them and go to their talks and that sort of thing. So number one, I'd say, you know, I'm a professor, I'm a teacher first. And then the research I do is kind of fun because I really get to just explore the sorts of questions that I have. I don't pull in big, you know, grants all that often. And then the art is something I would say that is kind of a side project for me. When those opportunities come up, right now I'm illustrating a larkspur for a friend who's describing a new species. And that I'm just doing because it's a fun project and he's a good friend of mine. The work I did for Michael Samways was kind of just a long-term project that we had planned. And it took quite a few years to finish. So, you know, and then some of the art stuff that I've been doing lately, which is some of the stuff that I think Jody's been seeing on Instagram, has been some of my turning it into some sort of fashion challenge for myself. So some of it's just purely for the joy of creating art. And my art obviously circulates around insects because that's what I love.
I was going to ask about the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators. Mm-hmm. Or illustration, right? Is that what it is? What's the
Guild of Natural Science Illustrators.
You're in a guild?
Okay. I know. Isn't it great that it gets to be called a guild?
That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm on the board. I'm the outreach director on the board of Guild of Scientific Illustrators. Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that? I remember seeing something about the meeting and I had to like dig up to see what that actually meant because I'm really bad with acronyms. And okay. It was cool that there was like this whole guild that it was a thing. And because, you know, I had just learned about how to draw.
Yeah. And I'm friends with several of these amazing people that are professional scientific illustrators. You know, I know people who work for National Geographic because they have a couple of scientific illustrators on staff. I know a lot of people are freelance. So people reach out to them with various projects. But really, it's just a group of people who are there to kind of support one another, answer questions. And these meetings are really amazing because they kind of bring everybody together to talk about what are some of the new innovations. So there are workshops. A lot of it is going digital now. So a lot of workshops about how to handle new technologies, but then also workshops on how to, you know, do basic scratchboarding techniques, carbon dust, all of those sorts of things. And it's a really great resource for people who are interested in scientific illustration because it provides this network of people who have been doing it for years that are very knowledgeable. And there's a great energy around those meetings because they're relatively small meetings compared to some of the larger meetings we're used to going to. There can be anywhere from 100 to 200 people attending the meeting. So you actually get to know everybody. They're usually held on college campuses, so everyone's staying in the dorms. So it feels like a little bit of a week-long party where everyone gets to geek out about science and art. It's one of my favorite things.
One of the cool things that you see circulating online around you is your fashion choices. I think this is one of the things that Jody really wanted to talk about with you today is some of your cool Into fashion. Is that the hashtag? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I've only been using Instagram since August, but last year was my first time of like looking at my wardrobe and like, wow, I have a lot of clothes with insects on them. And so last spring, I just challenged myself to see how many consecutive days I could go teaching wearing a different article of clothing. And I got to 30 days. and I was just posting it on my personal Facebook page. And then last fall, I'm like, okay, you know, I'll try Instagram. And so I started, you know, kind of posting some of the stuff on Instagram. And I'm on day 25 on Instagram, doing it just in the spring semester. But it's a lot of fun because I'm connecting with artists that use insects as kind of their main focus, or at least nature. And it's amazing how many entomologists are actually gifted artists at the same time. But it's been a fun way to kind of share my passion and love of insects. And I've been trying to, when I have time, you know, include some, you know, science communication. You know, these aren't just beetles on my shirt. It's this kind of beetle. You know, this is why they're important. I don't always have enough time to put that much content together, but that's the plan anyway, is that I'm going to try and use this as a little bit of a platform for outreach, because, you know, come for the fashion, but stay for the science communication, maybe is, you know, should be my motto.
During the quarantine.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit hard because all I want to do is wear pajamas every day.
There's got to be bug pajamas.
I know, it's odd. I really don't have that many. I have t-shirts that I can wear as pajamas, I don't really have good Into pajama fashion.
When I saw you in St. Louis at the outreach committee meeting, and you had the sweater, tell us about the sweater.
Well, there's a lot of good Into fashion out there if you just kind of look online, but really you find that most of the stuff that I guess is on the market is kind of cheesy. The stuff isn't really to the massive scale that I would prefer. Like if you're going to wear insects, wear big insects, you know? So I've started to kind of make some of my own clothing. And since I grew up as a 4-H'er, you know, my grandma taught me how to sew and knit. So it's been kind of fun to dust off some of those skills. And my mom's also very talented in those areas. So with the sweater, I actually found a chart that somebody else had made. So essentially it's just a pattern how you, you know, would construct a fly, and it's just a grid pattern. So I, you know, knit four flies into this sweater. So it's a fun project, and you don't see a lot of options out there to buy sweaters with big flies on them. So I took matters into my own hands.
Right. Well, and you've taken matters into your own hands a lot from what I can see. And you've made some of the coolest, like the underwing moth sweater. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Blouses. You're making shirts.
That's relatively new. My sewing skills are not the best, but I'm getting there. Like the fact that I was able to sew a collared shirt and have big beetles in the fabric design. That was fun.
I probably couldn't even sew a pillowcase.
Oh, sure you could. I actually took a sewing class locally last fall. It was just to like sew a simple dress. And that was kind of a nice like reassurance and kind of getting back into like, oh, okay, like it's just a matter of following the instructions and taking your time and not trying to power through and sew something in one day. Like I try and pace it out over a period of time.
Are there any particular retailers that you could point our listeners to if they wanted to search for some Into fashion themselves? Or would you say that they need to turn to the sewing machine and make it their own?
No, I mean, there are some really, like, so some of my favorite things that I've been collecting. But see, for me, it's all used on eBay and Poshmark, trying to, like, find these things on sale. Because the retail price of them originally was just awful. I don't know why, like, high-end designers know how to, like, do the Into fashion game so much better than other places, but they do. I don't own anything by Alexander McQueen, but I would love to. Like if you look up Alexander McQueen and beetle or insect or moth, I mean, his runway shows are just epic. And I mean, he's totally borrowing some of these ideas directly from insects. He's got a Goliath beetle dress out there right now that is insane. But of course, it retails for like $2,000. So I'm not going to get there at all. But Tory Burch, that's known for the handbags, that line has a lot of cool insect stuff out, but I'm like buying all of it used from, you know, old, like probably almost 5-10 years ago is where a lot of this stuff comes through. But that those are my favorite pieces are from that line.
How about for people like Mike and I, who I guess present as male to the outside world? I have a tough time finding things to wear myself. I have a few ties. Actually, I have more than a few ties. I have several ties that are insect themed. But other than that, I have a tough time finding things. I think I saw one blazer once at a meeting that was adorned with beetles. That was at Nebraska. Didn't that guy have a lady beetle one?
I think he was like the president of the Brunner Club.
Yeah.
He had it made somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's the thing is you might have to turn to actually having things made there. I mean, there I've seen men. I do have a men's shirt that has beetles all over it, and I managed to get that a couple years ago. But I mean, it's really kind of hit or miss with, you know. But I think that men's fashion does have insects on it almost more often than women's, just because I don't know why insects are more like okay for men to wear and not women. But I don't know. It's because it's kind of both parts. Yeah.
Just
no, I don't know. Well, it's always like for my daughter, I'd always go to the boys section to get her cool bug shirts, beetles and stuff. I think Target's been a little better. Like now you can find like dinosaurs and insects in the girls section, but really the best stuff's always over in the boys section.
That's true.
Yeah. We've bought a lot of boys shirts that have things on them about future bugologists and things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here.
I'm working on a project now that I've always been kind of fascinated by the beetle wing embroidery from like the Victorian era, where they would actually take these buprested beetle wings and adorn dresses back, you know, in the late 1800s. It was kind of a big thing. And so I actually just ordered a bag of these beetle wings from Thailand. I think they're like a byproduct. They raise the beetles to eat. And then so it's a pretty sustainable way of getting, they're not catching wild beetles and sending me the wings. I wouldn't be getting them for the price I'm getting of them if that were the case. They're actually really inexpensive. But I'm actually going to try and do some beetle wing embroidery on the back of a jacket.
That'll be awesome.
So through your Instagram and from Twitter, you do, what is it called? Is it called lino cut or whatever you're doing that looks so amazing, like stamping or
it's
so
really
cool
fun. I think anybody can do it. It's essentially just carving your own rubber stamps. You know, and I think you can get all the stuff at your local craft store and you just kind of draw what you want to carve out. And there's these sharp little tools that you use. And I don't have a really nice, you'll see these blades that are made in Germany and they're absolutely beautiful. And I'm sure they work way better than the Dick Blick, like, you know, speedball, you know, knives that I'm using, but I just switch the blades out pretty routinely to keep them sharp. And they work well. That's all I'm using. And but it's fun. You can carve out anything you want and have essentially the stamp that you can use over and over again.
You've made skirts, tiger beetles, right? Pattern. What else I see? Like tea towels and things like that.
Yeah.
And a shirt.
I have a shirt that's got trilobites all over it.
Yes. That one is so cool.
Yeah. I like that one.
That's awesome.
I know that people always ask like, where did you get that? And you're like, I made it. And it's one of a kind. Do you ever think that you would sell those patterns or ever want to do that? And I asked because my dad, he carves walking sticks and
oh, okay.
He got probably like 30 of them. If someone asks him for one, like he may make one for you. Like he's made one for my daughter with a head of a horse, but he's like, when people ask if he'll sell one, you know, he can't part with them. He's not even using a walking stick. It means so much to him that he can't give them away. Right.
Yeah. And I'd say that I'm definitely not doing it, you know, as a side gig or a side hustle, making some money. That would be great if I had that many hours in the day, but I don't. And honestly, like to put a price on some of those things, like that underwing moth sweater, by the time I'd be like, well, I spent $100 just on the yarn. And then, I mean, you're not saving money when you sew or make your own clothes at all, but then if you put in the number of hours and even making half of minimum wage, I mean, no one would want to pay those prices for these, you know, these articles of clothing. I've done a few trades, you know, where I've got friends that are artists and we might trade our goods. that's kind of it. But yeah, no, I don't. I've had people ask, you know, oh, can I buy? And I was like, no, but here's where you can go get the fabric, or here's, you know, here's the resources. Yeah. I'm happy to give anybody pointers, point people in the right direction. Absolutely. But yeah, no, I barely have enough time to play with this stuff on my own.
As we are kind of wrapping up here on the show, Tierney, is there anything that is there anywhere people can find you online that you'd like to share where they can view some of this cool stuff that you're making and we've been talking about?
Absolutely. I've been having a lot of fun over on my Instagram account, and that's just Dr.Beetle. So Dr. Beetle over on Instagram, or I think you can just look up my name, Tierney Brocious, on Instagram, and I think it pops up. So, and then I'm on Twitter, but that I'm mostly just, you know, retweeting science articles and once in a while, some of my Instagram leaks on over there, but not, I try and keep them separate. Twitter is science, Instagram is art. But of course, as you can tell, I tend to blend those two things together on a regular basis.
I was going to say, it sounds like it, your social media presence is your brain, sort of.
I think it is, which that maybe is a reason why some people should just stay away. But I do have a lot of fun.
Well, very cool. Look up Dr. Beetle on Instagram. If you want to find Arthropod online, we are on Twitter at @Arthro_Pod Show. If you want to find the hosts, I'm at Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugs Me, UNL.
I'm on Twitter at mscovarlo36. And since we brought up Instagram a bunch, if you want to see all of my children's train tracks that they build, you can follow me at StationMaster36 on Instagram.
StationMaster36. I love it.
It's literally just their wooden train tracks every time they build something new.
Fantastic.
I think one of the things I've learned through Arthropod is that every entomologist seems to have this hidden artistic side that we haven't always discussed openly in the society. So this is cool. I'm happy to hear from you, and I'm happy to learn that about everybody. So thanks for being on the show again, and hope everybody's doing well in quarantine out there. If you're affected by coronavirus, you're in our thoughts. We hope that everybody's being safe. And shout out to all the people who are still doing research and doing all kinds of awesome work in the midst of all of this chaos. So thanks for tuning in. Hopefully we provided some relief for you. And we will catch you here soon in a couple weeks on another Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
I have my dung beetle shirt on for you.
I love it. It's great.
But yesterday I was wearing the pubic lice t-shirt from the University of Florida.
That's like my favorite. I don't have that
the
one. And I feel
butterflies
like I
of love.
Yes.